before we begin the first bill, I'm good, so that the majority leader can have, be part of this lecture. Talking to the sergeants, they are having some problems with our rank system. When these were installed, they were never meant to be driven, other than the venerable part. And it's where the wires are breaking off, and so I said, well, if you want to just, I'll start with room 15. Please do not, please leave the mics in a stationary position towards you. If you have to talk to somebody, back off, or someone cover the mic. But rather than swiveling it back and forth, I think you should change that habit. Because we've developed that, I couldn't use it on the house, because they have a different system that's easier to swivel. And we get people coming over here from the house, and they bring their bad habits with them. But I didn't do that. But I appreciate it if we would leave those in position and use the swivel, but see if we can put this in a better way. So thank you for that, and thanks to the other room as well. So
that's good.
That had nothing to do with the static that we were having trouble with here, but that may be the interference with another electronic device. The first bill up is Senate Bill 1005. Senator Polk.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good afternoon. Senate File 1005 before you is a funds transfer for the Rockford School District. And I tell you, when it rains in Wright County, it pours in this regard. But perhaps if we want to start, Madam Chair, there is an author's amendment. I have an author's amendment, the 82 amendment, if someone would be willing to offer.
Madam Chair, I'll move that amendment.
Senator Cruz moves the 82 amendment to
Senate
File 105. All in
favor, signify
by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just go over what the amendment does, and then I will turn it over to the testifiers to speak to the bill. Staff can help me out here, but we had a fiscal note originally on this bill, an actual general fund amount, as well as it was a multiple year amount. And what this amendment does was, by reducing the amount, as you'll notice, by actually less than half, we avoid the multiple year effect. And by the last line, where it says is ineligible for debt service equalization on 1.5 and 1.6, that takes away the general fund fiscal note. So we're doing two things there. We're trying to tighten the year. It will be only for payable in 2012, and it will only it will not affect the general fund. So with that, you can all just tuck the fiscal note away. and then I would turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Senator Koch. My name is Paul Durand. I'm superintendent of schools for District 883, and joining me is Mr. Chuck Tryon, member of our Board of Education, and a former executive from Cub Foods. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to provide us the time to address you. You know that school administrators and board members get nervous when we come in front of legislators also. So this morning I put on a red tie. And I realized that might alienate part of the committee. So then I put on a blue tie, and that didn't look quite right either. So I went to a green tie, figuring we were going to be asking for a fund transfer. And also, it's our school colors. So we thought that might be safe. You know, 6-, 7-, and 8-year-olds don't vote. And it's up to adults to find viable solutions to many of the challenges that we face. I've worked in education for 32 years in rural Minnesota, Southwest and Jackson, Southeast Regional Center in Winona, served two suburban school districts, Brooklyn Center and South St. Paul, and yes, I've worked in an urban setting in St. Paul. So I believe I have some unique perspectives from different trenches around the state. First, thanks to all of you for the very difficult work that you do on behalf of the citizens, especially the children of Minnesota. You have tremendous responsibilities, pressures, and yes, the respect of many who truly understand how hard you all work to legislate within the context of your core values. You don't hear thanks enough, and I'm here to say thank you. And thank you for the hard work to to hold stable funding for education in these very, very tough times. In school districts across the state, we are also working very hard to properly use the revenues given by our taxpayers while balancing with that responsibility to educate our children, who hopefully will be the next greatest generation. But let me cut to the chase. Our request is simple yet critical for our district. We request you allow us to transfer $240,000 from debt service account into our capital outlay account for the sole purpose of major infrastructure repairs to roofs on two of our three buildings. This amount will keep us within the same tier at 19% debt service ratio, and the repair estimate that we have is about $920,000 over the next 2 years. If you look at the documents prepared, if you need to do that, you'll see that our district has on paper a little over $2 million fund balance, which is reserved for operating capital. This balance includes proceeds from a $1.8 million energy loan that $800,000 has been paid so far. So there is $1 million of that fund balance, reserve fund balance, that will pay the remaining energy project this year. And if one subtracts the necessary roof repairs out of the existing fund balance, our local challenge becomes immediately apparent. District 883, the Rockford Area Schools, will have less than $200,000 available to handle all the other capital outlay needs, from books to boilers, technology to track repairs, faucets to flutes. Simply put, we must have funds to repair our infrastructure while still having resources to serve the educational needs of our children. At this point, Mr. Tryon and I are more than happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you tell me, did the state, was your reserve such that the state would borrow or has borrowed any money from the district?
We were not in that situation.
Okay. I didn't think so. Thank you.
Thank you, members. Thank you.
And Senator Olson, specifically thanks to you and Senator Cope. Both of you are our representatives in Rockford, and we're well represented, so thank you very much. Every one of them voted for you, I guess.
That's true.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't think I grabbed my list. We have a number of individuals that want to testify and speak to this bill. As I'm giving a brief introduction, maybe they can come on up here and sit on either side of me and get prepared to make their statements and comments.
But, Chris McHugh and Kim Gibbons, I think for the...
Yes. Madam Chair, the bill before us is, it's focused around a response to intervention, and there, I'll give you a very brief introduction and let the experts speak to what they do and what they want to do, but basically what we would be trying to do here is create a framework where we can identify and help kids, help them succeed without waiting until they fail. Get to an intervention and nip the problem in the bud, as it were, rather than letting children be tagged and identified and put into categories of failing and otherwise. But Madam Chair, if we could let these people talk, they will tell you much more eloquently than I what this bill will do.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and Chris McHugh.
Thank you in the committee for your interest in this bill, and thank you for your past interest in the legislation that was passed in 2007. It is an honor to testify before you, and it is especially gratifying that this concept has had bipartisan support. Senate File 1210 addresses the identification of students with specific learning disabilities within the special education system. The bill also reestablishes the Minnesota Response to Intervention Center using existing federal funding. Although it may seem like a special education issue, it is not. This bill will have a powerful and a profound effect on the way all our students acquire and master the basic skills and indeed approach all their learning in school. RTI is not a program, but a framework that brings together classroom teachers, Title I teachers, and special educators out of their silos and organizes them to resolve problems earlier using scientifically based instruction, frequent and continuous measurement of student progress. Many Minnesota schools are using this model. Minnesota rules permit a response to intervention model, but only as an option to an older model, often referred to as the severe discrepancy model. This model has been widely criticized as a wait-fail model. It is difficult for students to qualify for special education until about third grade. But waiting until then to resolve reading and other problems bypasses the very years in which effective intervention can change a student's school career. In addition, some of the requirements now in place are not scientifically supported. The essential question is, why would we allow a model that requires children to first fail before providing valuable services? Why would we do this to our children? Our own experience, supported by leading researchers here in Minnesota and around the country, demonstrate that the RTI model is far superior in so many ways than many states such as Wisconsin, Iowa, Florida, and Colorado are moving to use the RTI model as the sole model for identification. Minnesota should join these leaders. The outcomes all accrue to students, as will be seen in the data of the St. Croix River Education District. Another important benefit, though, is that the time teachers save doing special education paperwork is significantly reduced in an RTI model, which enables teachers to teach more. The cost savings in time is in the millions of dollars. Training for Minnesota educators should be provided by the St. Croix River Education District, who have 30 years of expertise in this model. Federal law supports the use of such a model. It is time for the law in Minnesota to catch up to best practice and remove the wait-to-fail model from accepted practice and let the benefits of RTI flow to students and teachers. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for considering this bill. My name is Dr. Kim Gibbons, and I'm the Executive Director of the St. Croix River Education District, otherwise known as SCRED. SCRED has been implementing this framework for the past 30 years, probably more formally since about 1995. We, as a result of implementing this model, we have seen significant increases in student achievement for all of our students, increased growth for the kids that struggle the most, and a 50% reduction in the number of kids identified as specific learning disability over this time period. We've also, for the past 6 years, been using data from the Response to Intervention framework to make entitlement decisions for which children qualify for special ed services under the category of SLD. And as Mr. McHugh said, we also received a legislative allocation in 2007, and we ran a statewide center to support districts around the state in RTI implementation. I'm here to share the updated data with you from the last couple of years, and I think you have a packet in front of you. And I thought I'd actually start with the last page. which is the percentage of students receiving services for specific learning disability. And this is tracking it over since 1994-95. So if you look at your packet, you'll see that SCRED is the blue diamond. And then we're comparing ourselves to the state and also a neighboring region in our area. So you can see that in 1994-95, we were identifying 4.2% of our students as learning disabled, above the state average, above the regional average. And you can just see the downward trend. Over time, our most recent child count data from this December was we're identifying 2.4%. So I wanted to start by showing you that we've had a significant decrease in students with learning disabilities. If you now flip to the first page in the packet, I just wanted to show you the evidence that not only have we decreased our SLD category significantly, we've also seen huge achievement gains for all of our students. So the first graph that you're looking at is looking at the percentage of kids that meet target scores on a simple one-minute oral reading fluency measure. This measure is very reliable, valid, and it correlates very highly to the MCA, the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment. So we know if kids reach these target scores that we've set, that they have an 80% chance of being proficient the next time they take the MCAs. So you can see, it's hard to see, but when we started collecting data in 1996, only 20 to 30% of our students had reached those target scores that we had set. And now you can look at the more recent data and just see the tremendous gains that we've seen over the years, and particularly at our elementary schools, most of our grade levels are up towards 80% of kids proficient at this point. The second graph, the second page, is looking at the area of math. Our education district started focusing on reading as the primary push in the late 1990s, and for the past 5 years, we've really been focusing hard on math. So you can see that while the data isn't really up at that 80% range that we're shooting for, we've made a significant amount of progress in that area as well. The last graph that I'll point out to you is looking at the 10th percentile group of students across our education district. So a student at the 10th percentile is a student that's really struggling, and probably this includes all of our kids that are receiving special education services and then some extras as well. But instead of looking at the percentage of kids that are proficient, this is looking at the amount of growth that they're making over time. So at all of the grade levels, we've seen either a double or tripled of their growth rate over a 10-year time period. And I won't go through all the grade levels, but if you looked at first grade, you could see that in 1996, a student at the 10th percentile in the spring of first grade was reading about 15 words correct per minute, which is very slow reading. Those kids aren't comprehending anything of what they're reading. And our latest data point has a student at the 10th percentile reading 39 words correct per minute, and our target score is 49. So I think this data, along with the achievement data on all kids, really speaks to the preventative nature of this model, and that if we can serve kids the minute that we see that they're having difficulty and come in with comprehensive supports, that we really can reach that goal that we have of teaching all of our students to learn to read and be proficient by the end of third grade.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here to speak with you. My name is Dr. Elizabeth Lodge Rogers, and I'm the Executive Director for Student Services and Special Education for the St. Cloud Area Schools. The St. Cloud Area School District is a school district that has undergone a significant demographic change over the past decade. Currently, 50% of our students meet the free and reduced lunch poverty guidelines. Over 11% of our students are classified as English learners, and nearly 17% of our students are eligible and receiving special education services. I'm here to express strong support for Senate File 1210, which requires the Commission of Education to adopt and amend rules in order to establish a response to intervention model as the sole method for establishing eligibility standards for specific learning disabilities. as well as supporting the reestablishment of the Minnesota RTI Center. Proceeding down this course is really the most efficient scientific means to determine eligibility for students with learning disabilities. But most importantly, RTI is a process that reflects best practice and is best for students who are struggling as learners. The Senate File 1210 provides a means for building capacity within our Minnesota schools to change how we do business in order to best serve our children and to provide the result of closing the achievement gap. The support of early intervention through a response to intervention framework will help reduce the need for and the cost of long-term special education services. In my district, over the past 5 years, we have invested heavily in early intervention by implementing the RTI framework. The three schools that I can identify among our eight elementary schools that have been implementing RTI with fidelity and systematically are getting results. Review of our incidence rates for special education in these three schools, Discovery Community School, Madison Elementary School, and Kennedy School, show a decreasing trend line in the percent of students eligible and receiving special education services. This is despite an overall district figure that will shock you in terms of the increase in child count across our entire district. In addition, we're seeing the same decreasing trend line in the number of students referred for an initial special education placement in these three buildings. We're trying to replicate these efforts, logically, in our other schools, and we need support and we need technical assistance. The type of support in the form of technical assistance, coaching, mentoring, and problem solving around the barriers and obstacles that was available actually to Kennedy School when the former RTI Center was in place is what we need to transform our system across the state. The results are clear. In our district, the schools implementing RTI with fidelity and consistency are seeing declining numbers of students identified for special education. This is really best for our children, but it is also a cost benefit for our taxpayers. Special education at its base is a wait to fail model. We know that young children who have not learned to read by third grade are less likely to be successful, both in terms of school completion and, frankly, as citizen contributors to our greater community. It costs considerably more to intervene after children have failed. RTI is the most efficient and effective means to provide true early intervention for our students and to avoid children being labeled as disabled. I really ask you to please support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Rogers. Is Dr. Casey here, or is somebody?
Madam Chair, before we have the next testifier, I just want to—I noticed the—I think this handout was given to all the members with on my letterhead, and it's incorrect. It says there's no fiscal impact. I think that when the summary was put together by my assistant, the fiscal note didn't pull up on the system because you'll notice the fiscal note on the bill has a different Senate file number. I think that was done to kind of get around our system and expedite the process. So the summary sheet is incorrect. There is a fiscal impact. There is a fiscal note there. I just wanted to point that out to members. And that's why the Senate file does not match on the fiscal note.
Senator, you know, I don't think you were provided yet.
Okay. But I did also want to explain that the Senate file on the fiscal note is not the same as the Senate file, and that's just the way that it was requested.
Right. Madam Chair, all I'd say is that the fiscal note was expedited under Senate file 8999, and that's why it's a different number.
Hi, if I can introduce myself. My name is Melissa Chafin, and I'm a school psychology program lecturer at the University of Minnesota. And I'm here to talk with you about the fact that the discrepancy model that has been in place is really an unreliable and invalid means of identifying students who need assistance. These folks have talked to you about the RTI model and how it gets intervention services to kids early on, preventing a need to wait for them to fail to receive services. The discrepancy model that has been in place is really an unreliable and invalid means of identifying students. And when I teach students in the school psychology program to be school psychologists in the area of assessment, I really emphasize that tools that we're using need to be reliable and valid. Reliable meaning that they produce consistent results over time, and valid meaning they contribute to meaningful outcomes for kids. The discrepancy model is neither of these. Sure. The discrepancy model that's been used traditionally in the state to identify kids with learning disabilities states that we need to see a significant difference between their measured IQ score, so their score in one test, and their achievement as measured by another test. So kids qualify for services in part when they show that they have a significant difference between their IQ score, or how we'd expect them to perform, and their actual achievement as measured by an individually administered achievement test. So that's kind of the core of the discrepancy model for identifying kids. They're not achieving as well as we would expect them to based on their IQ score. Does that make sense? So this approach is really unreliable. Research across the country has shown that schools that use this method don't identify the same kids all the time, and they often ignore these criteria completely when making decisions about kids who should qualify for SLD services. What they do in practice is ignore the criteria when it suits them to identify kids who need help, who are struggling. It's also unreliable in that the tests themselves aren't perfectly reliable. Any test is measuring student performance on a given day. So factors like the fact that they didn't get a good breakfast or a good night's sleep can really impact performance. And when we're making important decisions based on two tests that are just measuring performance at one point in time, it's not a reliable way of identifying who needs help. The discrepancy model is also an invalid way of identifying kids who need help. We know from research that the degree of discrepancy between an IQ score and achievement score doesn't tell us anything about what we should do to teach kids. It doesn't give us an idea about the best way to help them learn. And in fact, it doesn't really even tell us who the kids with the most severe needs are. In addition, the tests that are used in this model are not fair for kids from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds. These tests measure things, aspects of culture and language, that kids from backgrounds other than the majority culture on which the tests are based may not have had access to or learned about. The discrepancy model, I think most importantly, fails to inform instruction. Knowing that a kid has a big difference between their IQ and their achievement doesn't tell us specifically what we need to do to test them. Understanding that information processes also does not tell us about what kids need to be taught. I think it's tempting to think that if we can test kids on an IQ test and identify some weak areas, that we could teach them those weak areas and that would lead to better gains in achievement. It's really tempting to think that way, but in fact, the research has not found this to be the case at all. I think lastly, I just want to point out that there is an alternative. Response to intervention is not a wait-to-fail approach. Instead, it identifies kids who need help early on and get them those services before they've had a chance to fail. And personally, practicing as a school psychologist and looking at parents who are concerned about their kids' performance and having to tell them that their child does not qualify for services because they're not achieving any different than we would expect giving an IQ test is an unfair practice that needs to be done away with. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question for Dr. Rogers. You mentioned that this would reestablish this program, this model. That implies that there was something established at one day. Can you share with us those of us that aren't as familiar maybe with the history, when it was de-established and why, so that we can help know why we should reestablish it.
I was referring to when we, the 2 years that the RTI Center was in place, and I think I'll let Dr. Gibbons respond because she was director of the center at that time.
Thank you. The St. Croix River Education District received a legislative allocation in the year 2007 to establish an RTI center to provide statewide support. So for 2 years, we worked with 54 school districts around the state of Minnesota. We did a needs assessment to establish where the districts were at in the process. And then we did comprehensive coaching, professional development. We worked with higher education to try to make sure that they were also infusing these concepts into, you know, their higher ed courses. And we basically provided technical assistance. Although we only worked with 54 districts around the state, we also provided technical assistance to a lot more. And in fact, I'm forgetting the exact number, but I think we had close to 3,000 staff people from around the state attend training sessions that were put on by the RTI Center. And then we didn't receive funding after the year 2009.
For other members, Mr. Nauman just asked me the statute. It shows 500,000 was allocated in 2008, and another 500,000 in 2009. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a big champion of your work and a huge fan and think it is the direction we ought to be going. I'm having a hard time understanding the logistics of the bill, how you envision with this framework really reaching 340 districts. And then I hadn't had a chance to go through the fiscal note, and I'm quite confused by it. So maybe I could ask Mr. Nauman to walk us through it, because it's pretty complicated, all the pages. And so I want to make sure that if we go forward with this, that we're actually have a framework that would work.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bonoff, I could answer your question, but not as well as these two to my left.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, did you want to hear about the bill first, or Mr. Nauman?
I think the bill first,
right,
of how we're actually going to make this happen. Although, I don't know, it could be either. Which,
right.
Madam Chair, it's the committee's
Mr.
pleasure.
Nauman, go ahead.
So members, I'm looking, perhaps what would help, because I think what's, there's a key issue in the fiscal note, and that is that Subdivision 3 assumes that there are federal funds available to pay for the cost of the contract. The Department of Education has made a different assumption that there are no federal funds available for this purpose, so that's why we have a healthy fiscal note. It comes in at $24.6 million and $12.1 for fiscal year 12 and 13. So it's an expensive, by any measure, cost. And it's based on the fact, as I said, that they assume that there are, if you look on the very last page of the fiscal note in the table, available federal funds are listed as zero. Now, if it might be worth having a conversation with the Department of Education about why that is, why the funds aren't available. But a different assumption would drop the number.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Nauman, things like law judge, 17,000, things like that, I'm not used to seeing.
Well, I think what you'll find if when you crawl into some of the detail here is that the department has further assumed that this will be a complicated rulemaking process. Sometimes, I mean, there's sort of a there's gradients of how much work is required in a rulemaking process. The bill does have some rules in subdivision 2. The department assumed that this would be a more complex effort, and that's where all that work comes from. And those are the costs for that effort.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Nauman, with regard to the IDEA funds, I mean, we certainly aren't fulfilling the promises that we've made to our schools, and we've kept the special ed growth. So where would these IDEA funds come from?
IDEA is a federal it's a federal law, and so I think the assumption in the drafting process was that those funds would be available for the purposes of fulfilling the contract in subdivision 3 of the bill. And as I mentioned earlier, the department makes a different assumption about that.
Okay.
Madam Chair, with regard to the bill, what Mr. Nauman is right, that this bill, basically the structure of it says that the commissioner shall develop a rule, and that's listed in subdivision 2. And then it also says in subdivision, so that actually develops a new framework, and that rule becomes effective really at the end of 3 school years in 2014. So that gives schools 3 years to gear up and prepare and to change their systems, which other states have done this immediately, which I think is a mistake based on our experience. But 3 years, and because many schools are already doing this, as Dr. Rogers has shown, they already have a basic foundation of how to do this. And this would give, for example, the St. Cloud schools 3 years to extend it to their other schools. In order to help is in subdivision 3. That's the Minnesota Response to Intervention Center. And Dr. Gibbons and her board at SCRED would set up something similar to what we did before and provide support to districts. And the bill is fairly specific about the activities of the center. And I think there's some direction in here that gives direction of what should be eliminated in the current model. And that goes to what Dr. Chafin was saying about what should be eliminated in terms of eliminate the severe discrepancy model in 3 years, and then also eliminate this requirement to processing disorder to figure out what students can and can't do based on psychological tests, which is a sort of a double leap and that's unnecessary and isn't supported by the research. So is that?
Yep. Madam Chair. Senator Nino, or whoever, Ms. Gibbons. So the way that this is written in terms of the Minnesota Response Intervention Center and the way the fiscal note has been done, do you think that you would have the resources and the staff to fully support the entire state rather than just the 54 districts? Because I think if we were to embark on this and do the rulemaking, we'd really want to make sure we could scale up and get it all done.
Yes, if you look in the bill, you'll see that there's language that would say that the Department of Education and St. Croix River Education District would agree on an amount that would be needed in order to fund this effectively. Currently, I don't have the staff currently. My staff are supporting 6 districts that belong to the St. Croix River Education District, so there would need to be some additional resources provided so that we could embark on a statewide effort. This is the first time I've seen that particular dollar amount stated. It's quite a bit higher than what I had in mind.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to start with a couple statements, too, and then I don't know who wants to answer it. First of all, I think I've been a longtime believer of ILPs, which is individual learning plans, where every kid should be on one. And I think it's important to identify the needs of all the kids. And first of all, with the discrepancy model, one of my degrees is in special education, and I think using the discrepancy model as the tool allows way too many kids to fall through the cracks. Because for those who don't understand, if there's not a discrepancy, they don't qualify for special ed. So you might have a child who might only have an 85 IQ who might be performing at 70, which is still going to be, you know, really struggling, but they're not going to qualify. So I think that's, you know, that is a not the greatest tool for identifying, but I do think it's still a good tool for understanding some of the problems. My question, and maybe you answered it and I just didn't catch it because I was trying to put too much of this together. How are you identifying needs, and then how are you providing the services for, I mean, you could have a class of 30 kids with, you know, 12 different levels. So how do you envision identifying and then actually servicing each of those individual needs?
Yeah, thank you. Wonderful question. Within the RTI framework, there's an assumption that we work with districts on creating tiered services of support. So we start out with the core instruction that all kids get, and we make sure that that's as effective as it can be. And we look at the data, and if we see that, you know, only 50% of second graders are reaching target, then we know there's something's going on with the core instruction that needs to be improved and enhanced. We also know that even if we have the greatest core curriculum available, there's still going to need to be some kids that need something extra. And that's where we come in with supplemental interventions for students. And then we collect data. We use a problem-solving model to identify for each student what the problem is, why it's occurring, what a good research-based intervention would be. We make sure that that intervention is being developed with fidelity. And then we look to see if the problem's, you know, getting reduced, if that discrepancy between what we expect and what's occurring is reducing. And paramount to all of this is the assumption that we work with school districts on looking at data. And so we don't wait anymore for teachers to make referrals, that we screen our kids 3 times a year. And after each screening period, we sit down with the teachers in the grade level and we look at the data and say, who are the kids that are struggling, that aren't making it based on the core curriculum, and then really come in with those tiered levels of support. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Nina, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. Some of you know that I have a son that is disabled, went through the public school system, and I think this looks like a great model. My question probably is to Madam Chair, actually. This fiscal note, I'm trying to figure out how this fits into the big scheme of things, and how do we pay for it? Right.
But the bill has been introduced, and I think it was worthy of our hearing. We're not probably going to be acting on it today, and I don't know if there's going to be a miracle or something pouring down from heaven that would allow us to go forward. But who knows? Strange things can happen in the legislative process. But I think it's important for us to have this issue before us, and people could be getting up to speed, and we have opportunity both to hear the response of people if there are concerns. You know, the first time a bill was written, it's not always perfect. And so we've... Mr. Nam is shocked. if we didn't have to improve it, we wouldn't be necessary. So I think it's important that we do scrutinize this and hear the consequences, the ramifications, and then, you know, I think the model did have some good results, and for whatever reason, was not funded to continue. And I don't think that was based necessarily on any judgment of a fact or effectiveness. And so, therefore, I think it's worthy of our reconsideration and looking at bringing our state into line and hopefully into leadership. It's very tightly linked with my passion, which you heard me talk about reading by third grade and all reading to Scott and that kind of thing. And that it's that model is very complementary. I mean, it is not a program. It's a model and a process. And it's one that the effectiveness of how it's about interventions. You know, if they're going to change the intervention, you've got to have a kit bag and the tools and know something about what given this kind of performance or what you've learned about that child as to what's going to be effective for them. So, life isn't simple in this business, but I think we've learned enough things that we don't have to wait until the end of the year for a test or, place all our hopes in one test or another. And I think that's one of the things that Track Little Center ultimately felt when we were working on the literacy issues to this, is that you really did get some good feedback. We visited up there and saw the groups of teachers who were collaborating together administering some of these just very short tests that give some indications to whether that growth is continuing or whether they need to modify the process that they were using for instruction. So, how much we can bring the attention to it, and I think it would help us to find out how many districts have implemented it. Where are they getting training now? Where are they getting it? But what's the value? I think you've had some good experiences with it. We need to find ways to deliver this. Maybe one of the things that's going to come one of these days is some of that development might be possible to be on a virtual basis, so that more people, they don't have to drive hours to come to a thing that you could do an interactive on through the internet and learn and just multiply the effectiveness, probably for much less cost. So I think there's lots of things that we can do, and I think we ought to start thinking about that. That's a long-winded answer to your question.
And Madam Chair, being I believe in divine intervention from time to time, I'm going to put my trust in you that we're going to be able to find a way.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions. One is, it'd be interesting to know where the Department of Education stands on this. And the other one is, when you look at the payments for, let's say, federal reimbursements and federal dollars, do they, what are the federal guidelines in terms of how they look upon the RTI?
Madam Chair, Senator Stumpf, this model, I briefly said that this model is supported by federal legislation. As you might know, the federal law idea that Mr. Nauman was referring to is overdue for reauthorization. Representative Klein is working on that, as is the Senate. But one of the things that apparently they've agreed to is to try to link so that both the existing No Child Left Behind and IDEA have this concept in there. They refer to it as multi-tiered levels of support, as Dr. Gibbons has said. But so I think this is allowed in federal law. In fact, it was very unusual language because they didn't allow the state departments across the country to prohibit local education agencies such as SCRED and St. Cloud from implementing this model. And as a result of that, in 2004, our State Department had to change the rule so that that's allowed, and that's in the current rule. Part of the idea of funds is that states can retain a certain percentage of funds for statewide projects. And you as a legislature have to approve the expenditure of that money. And so when the department says that there isn't money to do this, I think that becomes the subject of some discussion and oversight, because I think I would suggest that one might want to talk about what projects the department is doing and what projects might we do, and might this be one that can be fitted in with the existing appropriation. Very similar, No Child Left Behind money, has a similar type of thing, which I won't expand on. I just wanted to point out, Madam Chair, if I could, that we have in the packet a letter from former Assistant Secretary Robert Pasternak. Dr. Pasternak, he was the Assistant Secretary in charge of special education under President Bush. And he's strongly endorses this and has been with us and met with us previously when, in 2007.
Madam Chair, if I could, the other part of my question relates to what higher education is doing. You mentioned that when you're teaching, you use this, but aren't you? I mean, is this some a model that is prevalent enough that the students are going to go out to the districts and work and find no place to use their talents, basically, or what's higher education's response to this? And
yes, Madam Chair, this is really best practices. This is Chafin. Yes. This is really best practices. This is recognized nationally as the way that we should be going, because this model has the most research support. So at the University of Minnesota, we're training our school psychologists to operate within this model, recognizing that this may not be an option everywhere that they go and work. You know, we want to be part of changing that, I think, and getting the research out to schools to help them make better decisions about practices that are being used. The discrepancy model that's been in place does not have empirical support. Response to intervention has growing empirical support, and it's been well established in many places to be working and to provide better outcomes for kids, including lower costs, because we're catching kids before they fail. We're giving all kids better instruction, and then we're targeting resources for the kids who really need it.
Dr. Levin, how would you tie in with the department that is training special education? Does this fall within the jurisdiction of the psychologists entirely, or is that, are you members of the team that is a part of the action?
Yeah, good. Good question. It's definitely a team effort and a team approach. And RTI, I can speak for the University of Minnesota, is something that's taught to our special education teachers as well.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I just wanted to follow up on Senator Stump's question about are we going to train people, and then are they not going to have an opportunity to use their skills? There is a national RTI center that's in place, and they did a survey within the last year of a random sample across the country and found that over 60% of school districts across the country are implementing this framework in some way, shape, or form. So I think it's fair to say that there's a lot of momentum building, and I would be surprised. It would be surprising, with my experience, what's going around the country, that no one would have ever heard of this model. I mean, people are at different stages of implementation, but.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a great supporter of this concept. As a former special education teacher myself, I can relate all too often to how kids are denied services because we're waiting until they're far enough behind. And that just doesn't make sense educationally. So my hat's off to you for that. I just have one question about the bill itself. And it's on page 2, about lines 2.33 and 3.4 and 3.5. I guess my question, and this might be for Senator Nenow, is it usual? I'm just a little uncomfortable legislating that we ask the state to enter into a contract with a particular vendor. And I just am not a, I don't find that we've done that frequently, at least that's my recollection. And I'd just like either some comments from council on that or comments from the appropriate folks on that.
Well, certainly I don't want to give an answer for council or staff, but it is not unprecedented. We see that on occasion. In this particular circumstance, it was an appropriation specifically given to SCRED in the past, and we essentially would just be jump-starting that up again with this program. But if council or staff or whoever wants to add into that, certainly.
I think there's a theory that the windows back there, I don't know if he's going to interject a bit of history.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, Bob Wadle. That's a very good question. But in this case, as you indicated, legislation has already on the books directing the state to contract with SCRED to do certain pieces of work. But there are other precedents in law. For example, you're considering a bill that says that the department will contract with Serve Minnesota to carry out the AmeriCorps program. There are other examples like that in law. But I do think, Madam Chair and members, that there's also a broader concept on the table. At one time, state assistance meant assistance provided by a state agency. That was a given. But I think in today's era that we need to look at that a little bit differently. We should say that state assistance should be provided by whomever in the state is best able to provide it. And our wonderful Commissioner of Education and Department of Education is fully capable of providing a lot of assistance in a lot of areas. But in this particular area, there is nobody better than SCRED to do this. So if we want leadership and service in the 21st century, I think you're going to be turning to who can best provide that. And in this case, this is who can best provide it. They work with kids every day. They've got a long track record of implementing this model. They're recognized around the country for their competence in this area, highly qualified. The whole lot of them are PhDs out of the University of Minnesota or Oregon, I hear. And so they're highly competent. So in this case, with this particular situation, you want to turn to who can best do this, and the answer is SCRED.
Just a brief follow-up. I agree 100%. We should be looking at who can best provide the services we need. And just my uncomfortableness is just pointing into legislation one particular group, because this may be the case today, but it might not be tomorrow. And my thought would be that the department would obviously choose whoever can best provide the services. And in this case, if everything we're hearing is exactly correct, then it would be SCRED. So it's just something to consider as we move forward.
But Senator Nelson, I think we did make a change in terms of the reporting.
Yes, we did.
Senator Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Gibbons, not to put you on the spot, but I noticed you had a reaction about the fiscal note. And as we are in an environment of scarce resources, we want to make sure we're looking at the numbers. And in 2008, we spent $500,000, same amount in 2009, and you said that was for 54 school districts. Mm-hmm. If we're going to do this statewide, what's your best guesstimate? I won't hold you to a certain number, but maybe a range of what you think that this would cost.
Madam Chair? That's a very good question. Last year, the U.S. Department of Ed released applications for what was called an I-3 grant, Investing in Innovation and Education. SCRED completed an I-3 grant to basically reestablish the RTI Center in Minnesota to provide statewide support. We had 78 points out of 80. We had we got full credit on the full grant application, and then there were 5 competitive preference points. And for some odd reason, we lost points because they said we weren't going to serve rural school districts. And I work for rural school districts. Anyway, that application was for $5 million over 5 years. That was 5 years, $1 million a year. And I have a copy of that application proposal, and I think we put a lot of time and effort. As Senator Olson said, there's a lot of different forms of technology that's out there with distance learning and online professional development. When the RTI Center was in existence, we did use Adobe ProConnect, which is an online meeting software, to do coaching around the state so that people didn't have to drive. So I do believe that there's a lot of economical ways to provide the support. The reaction that you saw for me was just that I hadn't seen the information, and $24 million seemed high to me. So Yeah. So I, you know, when I wrote the I-3 grant, I felt like we could do the job for $5 million over 5 years.
Madam Chair, a quick follow-up. Would that have covered all school districts in Minnesota?
Yes, it would have.
$24 million for the first year, $12 million the second year. That's $36 million that I see here versus $5 million over 5 years. What are the differences? Can you help explain the difference? Oh, I would never. Madam Chair, I would not challenge you nor the fiscal note. Is it apples and apples? Is what she would provide for the million the same as the assumptions that are in this?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Stumpf asked earlier, but I'd still like to hear from the department on this and what they're relatively new, but perhaps the staff that has been here learned something about the previous contract that was awarded that they could shed light on or what their thoughts are on this whole proposal.
Senator Stephen, I think they have gotten the message and they have appeared. So I welcome you to the table. Thank you so much.
Definition of maltreatment.
They don't all have to leave.
We scared them off.
Sure. Brian Shackleton, Department of Education, and we do have some serious concerns with this legislation, and I am more than happy to let our staff address them.
Thank you.
Kara Hokanson, Department of Education, Division of Program Finance.
I'm Barbara Trulene, Director of Special Ed Policy at the Minnesota Department of Ed.
Which
should we start with the fiscal note?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I worked on the fiscal note. I took the lead on it with the help of Special Education Policy, Barb Trulene, who's the director of. You asked for a discrepancy, and in the fiscal note, you'll see the assumptions, but this is a statewide model proposal. It assumes that all teachers in the state will be trained. If you have a statewide model, you need to train all teachers. There are 52,000 teachers in the state. And we took an average of about $425 for a three-day class in our set workshop, and that is what is the going rate. A session in Rochester costs that much. So we applied the number of staff that need to be trained times $425. That was the cost for training, and then there's follow-up. You just don't train a staff person once. You're going to have to do a lot of follow-up. That was also built into the cost of the fiscal note in one-third of the staff. So we had a statewide, we were going to assume that all staff were going to be trained. There was follow-up needed for that. There was development of materials and training, which are articulated in the fiscal note. We assume that the bill says that the contract is a two-year contract and that the bill assumed that the work would be done in 2 years. There is the cost of the rulemaking, which the bill requires the department to promulgate a rule. So that is built into the fiscal note as well. There, as if you're going to use with any project or contract, you need to evaluate the project. Standard OSIP cost is 10% of the cost of the contract. That was built into the contract as well. And I think that basically was the assumption. This is a statewide model. This is training districts, charter schools, everywhere, statewide.
And every teacher.
Every teacher, 52,000 FTEs.
Hi, Barbara Trulene. A couple of concerns that have come to the attention of our staff is that we are huge fans of prevention and intervention, and we're working very hard in the area of positive behavior supports. That's one example of things that work really well as response to intervention. But just a reminder that this is a general education, all education framework, and the link to it is through the LD criteria as an option. And Minnesota currently offers this door as an option. We don't require the severe discrepancy. We give a choice to school districts at the current time. And it takes several years to implement a well-organized framework as complicated as this is, as much training as it requires. It is not something that you can do in a short amount of time without some compromise. And I think some of the literature suggests that to fully implement this with fidelity, meaning you're doing it the same across your different schools, different sites, will take a couple of years to do. And so it's going to require doing it well, and therefore we made some assumptions with the fiscal note that would require extensive training. Another point, I think...
Madam Chair, that is the assumption. There are classroom teachers, those who have direct contact and instructional support of students would be included, be trained.
I think you bring up an excellent point, Madam Chair, that the bill does lack some specificity in terms of what is meant by the term RTI, including the content area and ages that are covered by the mandate, because there's a wide variety of implementation in this regard, and the scope of the proposed mandate is a little unclear, although broad. You have heard from champions today and pioneers and great leaders, but we have many people that have only attended perhaps an introductory workshop, or there's interest, there's some very beginning interest in it, but it takes a while for things to get to the scale where there's going to be buy-in by an entire school or site to make this possible. So we just have some concerns about the ages that might be covered in here. We also look at this as the bill assumes a void in content knowledge related to the items without identifying other resources, training activities, and partnerships. There's enough work in the world of positive behavior support and any prevention intervention for everybody. We have a North Central Comprehensive Center. We have a Center for Instruction. We have state implementation scaling up evidence practices. We have national, region, state, and local. And I think to do this well, it's going to take everyone's effort, including some centers of excellence, no matter where they might be. There had been some question about a contract before. And the general practice at the department, I can only speak from my experience in being here 5 years, is that things go out for competitive bid. Particularly when there might be several entities or several places that could potentially perform the duties. And if indeed, based on the experience and the expertise, that entity is selected, then that entity is the one that performs some of the responsibilities and tasks that the department has identified as a need. So those are a couple of the concerns. I did appreciate the reference earlier to the reauthorization of the Elementary Secondary Education Act and the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act coming up soon, and hope that in both reauthorizations there's an opportunity to get beyond this being best practice, that it might indeed become an actual requirement.
Is there any quick question? We've got one more bill, and we are getting real tight. And
I did. I'll try and make it as quick as I can. And ma'am, I'm sorry. I didn't catch your name. And the brown sweater with the scarf?
Carol Hawkinson, Division of Program Finance.
Ms. Hawkinson, Madam Chair, just some quick questions. I'm looking at the regional coaches, and $100,000 seems like an awfully large amount of money. So I was hoping that you could go into a little bit more detail on the assumptions you made with that. What are the qualifications of these coaches? Does that amount include benefits, travel? Would the assumption be that after a certain point in time we would not need those coaches? Or is this going to be a permanent fixture?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, $100,000 is a standard. When you're assuming a one FTE full-time equivalence, $100,000 represents a salary at an education finance two level plus benefits. So it's the full package. So it's one full-time equivalent. I assume that it was an specialist two standard salary. And that person would be needed for the duration of the contract. There are, I assume, the regionals using the Educational Cooperative Service Units as your geographic regions. There would be an area trainer throughout the state, nine of them.
Okay. Thank you.
Keeping her honest.
Always. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for the record. Jody Boer with Education Minnesota. And really just a couple points that we want to make, and I understand based on the conversation before that this bill is probably going to be laid over or held and hopefully further discussion. So I'd just like to reach out personally and let Senator know that we would also like to be part of the discussion. We have, you know, many teachers, many experts in this field, so we would like to be part of those discussions if we could. We really have just two main comments, and one is that while we think RTI is a good program and serves a great purpose, and the experts before me have covered that in great detail, but our concern lies with that the bill recommends that it be the sole tool, and we do not think that it should be, and nor is it intended to be, and we can discuss that in further conversations. The research shows by even those who support RTI, which we also think is a good program, that it is meant to be a standalone. So that's one comment that we'd like to discuss further. The other, and it's been discussed some, is about the funding and who's going to be in charge of rolling this out, should it roll out. And we do think if you're looking at a comprehensive statewide program, all of the people that need to be trained and reached by this, that we think it would be best to put it within the department and, of course, be funded. So we think that's something that should be considered and or potentially looking at, you know, the RFP process or something. We think that the work that the St. Croix Center has done has been very good, and they are a great resource. But we think something of this magnitude, if it does roll forward, should be under the Department of Education. So with that, Madam Chair, committee members, thank you. I hope I kept my promise.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
It's good to have your input. I think it gives lots to work on.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. I'd like to move Senate File 540, and I also have an author's amendment. Madam Chair. And I'd also like to thank my co-sponsors, Chair Olson, Senator Bonhoff, Senator Senjum and Senator Rosen as well. Members, this is a bill that actually I think is a piece of legislation that we probably won't see enacted very often, or I should say it won't need to be used very often, but it's very important that we get this in place. Senate File 540 allows a board of teaching to take action on a teacher's license if the teacher was terminated by a school board for maltreating a student. And I know you must think that just sounds unreal. How would we ever have a teacher maltreating a student? Those two things do not go together. They ought not go together. And I will say that it's very rare that that happens. We have 50,000 teachers in the state of Minnesota. And according to MDE, last year they found that there were 19 cases of maltreatment in our classrooms. And I'm sure that you all would agree with me that one is too much. We should never have a student in a classroom where a teacher would maltreat that student. And for goodness sakes, if it ever happens, we never want that teacher to be able to just be terminated and then go to the neighboring district or the next school district and get a job, again, working with students. So that is the genesis of this bill. I have several testifiers with me today who will testify about the bill. Before I do that, I want to just make one comment about the fiscal note. I want to thank the department. They went back and revised their fiscal note. They are able to implement this within existing resources. So there is a fiscal note, but there's no cost. And so I want to thank the department for that. With that, Madam Chair, if I might be able to turn testimony over to Heather Lindwell.
Do you want to start first?
Okay, yeah, I think, Madam Chair, it'd be better if we had... Okay, Mrs. Well, I think you need to hear from Mrs. Herman. Yes. I think we should hear from Mrs. Herman because actually it was her son who was the impetus for this legislation.
Good afternoon. Kind of a cold, so hopefully you can hear me okay. Yes, thank you for listening. Yes, exactly, last year. Yeah, we're hoping for to continue the efforts that the students from Concordia started last year on behalf of my son and passed eventually the bill in 2010. So we're looking forward to hopefully getting a bill passed this year as well in honor of his name and the unfortunate occurrence that happened to him in the 2006 school year. I'm not sure how much everybody's aware of Kyle. I see that you have the brochures that the students from Concordia prepared and kind of lay out. But basically, I'll give you a thumbnail sketch because I understand we're kind of shortened with time. But my son Kyle has Down syndrome. He's the oldest of our three kids. He started school in 2006 and was abused by his special education teacher. Throughout that whole school year, we had numerous issues of acting out in school. He was nonverbal, so he couldn't tell us what was happening to him. The school staff repeatedly told us they had no idea what was wrong with him. Then we immediately turned to thinking that there was some maybe physical that was bothering him. We took him to a medical specialist, put him on a gluten-free diet. Then abruptly at the end of that kindergarten year, we were told that there was potential maltreatment by his special education teacher, but we were not weren't told any of the details of it because it was a privacy issue with the teacher. The school ultimately did their private investigation. In the following December, they determined through an arbitration hearing that she did indeed maltreat our son, but we still weren't able to find out the details of all the heinous things that she did to him until May of the following year. So it was almost 2 years after the initial most egregious incident that we finally found out what she did with him. Did to him throughout that whole school year, and we're just hoping that through this legislation that we passed last year and our continuing efforts with the students this year that we can kind of add on to that, and so other parents don't have to go through the same problems that we went through. Particularly, we found out after the fact with this particular teacher that she was caught dragging a student in the Minneapolis Public Schools the previous year that she started in Spring Lake Park. And there was another incident, too, that she, another little boy that she injured during the same school year that she injured my son, that she just about killed him because she manipulated the straps of his wheelchair, just about suffocated him. So I think there's a repeated pattern for some people that, you know, that might get away with this. And I really hope that, you know, some of this legislation, again, that we can pass to stop these incidents and from people coming back into the system to working with our kids. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now I have Heather.
Yes.
And introduce yourself to the table, please.
I'm Heather Linville. I'm a student at Concordia University. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name, again, is Heather Linville. I'm the president of the Concordia Student Legislative Action Team, and I would like to quickly thank Senator Nelson for working with us on this bill. She's been a great leader during this process, and we're really grateful. And also thank you to our co-authors, who she mentioned earlier. We're overwhelmed by the bipartisan support of this effort. And then also I'm just representing these other group of students behind me, along with our professor Jane Jones, who's kind of led us through this entire process. I come before you on behalf of this group as well, over 1,500 supporters whom have joined the Kyle Herman team, and I'm here with concern that needs to be addressed immediately. As you'll remember, a year ago today, Governor Pawlenty signed the bipartisan Kyle Herman bill into law. This was a superior step in the right direction, changing Minnesota law and moving towards eliminating abuse within the classroom. And there's kind of more information in this blue book that we pass out to all the committee members, so I won't really go in too much into that. But really quickly, since last year, we've been busy with legislative activities concerning the Kyle Herman bill. We've received recognition and support from many, including former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, Vice President Joe Biden, and former Chancellor of Washington, D.C. Public Schools Michelle Rhee, as well as many others. We've been asked by Congressman Paulson to assist him in lobbying federal legislation that promotes equal benefits for those with special needs. And with that, we're lucky enough to meet and work with Senators Amy Klobuchar, and Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, and Congressman Waltz. But today, you have the opportunity to help us in our efforts to protect students. And our bill is straightforward, just reiterating what Senator Nelson said. In two quick points, Senate File 540 does what many find to be common sense. The legislation requires the Board of Teaching and the Board of School Administrators to refuse to issue, renew, or automatically revoke a teaching license for termination or discharge showing teacher discharge due to minor maltreatment, and also requiring model policy for mandatory child maltreatment reporting and by school district employees. So again, we appreciate your time, and we would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a very quick question. Just in terms of clarification, Senator Nelson, I'm curious about kind of the level of maltreatment in here. It seems like it's kind of an incomplete thing. I don't know if it is defined earlier in the legislation. Is this maltreatment allegation, maltreatment report, or maltreatment determination? Because it's not clear in the language. It just says the school board for maltreatment of a minor. Is it a maltreatment determination?
Yes. Madam Chair, I believe maltreatment is defined in statute already, so we're just going with the current definition. And if you look on 2.6, 7, and 8, you'll notice the new language specifically says that the revocation or refusal to renew would incur if there was a termination or a discharge showing that the teacher had been terminated or discharged by the school board for maltreatment of a minor. So there really has to be, it's a two-step thing there. Not only does there have to be maltreatment, but it has to be such that the school board has said, we don't want you in this district anymore. So it's not just if something happened, and actually there was a case when I was visiting with a person from the Board of Teaching where they had seen a very innocent case of something that would have been maltreatment. But, of course, the school district in that case said, oh, this is a great teacher, this is something that happened unintentionally, and we definitely want to retain this teacher. This legislation will only take effect when a teacher has been terminated because of maltreatment. So we think we kind of have that covered. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Nelson. To Senator Torres-Ray's point, I tend to agree. I would want to know what that definition of maltreatment is. So if that is contained in the statute, maybe counsel whatever definition is applicable, because this is a pretty harsh situation for someone, and I think that the degree of maltreatment would have to be pretty significant.
Okay, with that, I think we're going to call it recess, and we will reconvene at 5:30.
Price cross reference.
I apologize if we can't keep, but this, we're getting that time of year.
This refers to those two statutes.
And Chair, should we leave our things here?
Madam Chair, I think we have state government too at 6.
Yes.
Are we convening? So you, the four of us are, I mean, in half an hour. Okay.
Some of us
thanks.
Are third committee
at the same time.
There's two that I know.
Thank you so much. Would you like to stay?